Hello, this is Paul Green, political analyst, WGN Radio, and chairman of the City Club of Chicago. This morning for breakfast, we had State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, who gave an impassioned speech why she should be renominated for the position of State's Attorney in Cook County, and she literally knocked the ball out of the park, answering every question, including on the controversial cases.
Well, good morning. And sorry I was a little late. It was a little hard getting in the front door here. You know, I see the same group of people. I've gotten to know them. So as a mother, I hope maybe we can give them some to-go bags, you know, so to make sure that that they eat today. But in any event, I am very happy that you all got up early to come down here and listen to me speak. I want to thank Jay Doherty and the City Club. This isn't my first time here. I've been here several times before. It's always fun. And Paul Green, of course, for and the fact that he and his wife is also a Maria High School grad, so we have that in common. And I want to thank you for being here. It's great to be back, and it's great to be able to talk about the role of the Cook County State's Attorney in the criminal justice system and also my campaign for re-election as your state's attorney. I don't know if all of you know this about me, but maybe you do by now if you've seen my campaign commercials. I am a runner, and yes, that is really me, running in the ad on the streets in my old neighborhood. We went back to Pilsen to film those running shots. I have been a runner since my days on the track and field team at Maria High School. And, Paul, I still have my Maria High School track jacket. It's kind of hokey looking, but it still fits, so that's good. But at this, you know, at my age now, I run really for my health. And to be honest, some days I run to get out of the house and get away from those teenagers. And, you know, and lately when I see a group of reporters, you know, I feel like I'm Forrest Gump. I could just keep running and running and running and running. I think I could run from here to California if I had to. But mostly I run for my sanity. So I don't think it'll be a surprise of any of you that when you see that I've been doing a lot of early morning running lately just to make sure that I can get through the days of these very, very filled campaign days. As this campaign has moved forward, I am getting stopped everywhere I go, you know, from supporters, from citizens on the street. Whether I'm out running at Macy's department store or at my friendly neighborhood Jewel, I can't seem to get past the deli counter without somebody stopping me and talking to me. And all I'm really trying to do is buy my lunch meat to feed my kids for the week. But someone always recognizes me. And they come up to me and they tell me their stories, telling their stories about their friends or their relatives. Many of these people have been victimized or impacted by crime, and they tell me how they have received a measure of justice as a result of the work of our incredible, dedicated prosecutors. I've been stopped by mail carriers, truck drivers, hairdressers, school teachers, and even a convicted felon. Just 2 weeks ago, as I was running, and I was about three blocks from my house, I was just running, and I heard someone yell out my name, and I stopped, and I looked. And I see a man waving to me, and he's smiling, and he has his hand out to shake my hand, so I stopped. And he didn't waste any time, and he just said, "Miss Alvarez, hi, I'm Tony, and I'm a convicted felon." And, you know, as you can imagine, the introduction made me a little anxious. I'm like, okay. But then Tony went on to tell me that having been in the system, he understands the system, and he understands criminal cases, and he understands how it is to put cases together. He also told me that he made a mistake as a young man. He told me he had a felony conviction at the age of 22, but he was 36 now, and he hasn't had anything since. And he has turned his life around, and he's a husband, and he's a father. And in fact, he pointed to the school where his children go. He said he has a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And he's a productive member of the community. He told me, "I can vote, and I intend to vote for you. And I think you are a woman who is honorable and honest. And can I take a selfie with you?" So here I was in the middle of the street, you know, and not looking very good for a picture. And Tony took a selfie with me. But I say that because everywhere I go these days, that seems to be happening to me. And for someone like Tony, who has been through the system and has seen the inside and the outside, I found it very humbling for him to stop me and to say the words that he said to me. And those kinds of encounters that I have each and every day is what keeps me going and reinforces in my mind that I am the right person to continue to do this job. The political experts tell me that there is always a margin of error of some kind, but if my unofficial jogging poll is accurate, I really like my chances in this race. That's because the final decision is not going to be in the hands of politicians or of party bosses. The final decision is going to be left in the capable hands of the hardworking men, women, and families of Cook County who put a high value on public safety and who demand honest answers from candidates running for important elected positions. As you know, there are very many important issues to debate in this race for Cook County State's Attorney, but I think that the number one issue that we need to discuss is violent crime and the horrific crime rate here in the city of Chicago. Since the beginning of this year, there have been 93 homicides in the city of Chicago. Just think about that, 93 homicides. Let me repeat that number. I mean, 93. I've been doing this job a long time. I've been in this office for 29 years. I don't think I've ever seen, that number so quickly at the start of a year. So just over 50 days, 93 people have been murdered in our city. If the violence continues at this rate, Chicago will be on track for nearly 700 murders for the first time since the late 60s. That is just unconscionable. We have a crisis of violent crime here in Chicago, an epidemic of gun violence, and a flood of illegal guns getting into our streets. The cases and the victims have become all too familiar. The beautiful, young, aspiring model who's gunned down in a drive-by shooting, the little girl who's brutally assaulted and left for dead, the 9-year-old who is executed, and we've had two cases where 9-year-old little children have been executed. I am personally prosecuting the case of 9-year-old Antonio Smith. Antonio was a little boy murdered in cold blood in 2014 as part of a gang-related shooting. The violence we see day in and day out is tragic and it's appalling. And yet, even in the face of so much tragedy and the disappointment, and the disproportionate effect of these crimes on minority communities, even after 93 homicides, we don't see more resources coming to prosecute crime or to address the poverty and other social problems that feed this never-ending cycle of violence. In fact, what we have been seeing is just the opposite. At the state level, drastic cuts to social services loom as the governor and the legislature remain deadlocked on a budget. We still don't have them. At the county level, my office has been forced by the county board president and board to cut our staff and budget each and every year. As the number of murders rise in Cook County, the resources we commit to prosecuting violent crime continue to shrink. That is the backdrop from which we must work to reform and improve our criminal justice system, and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in particular. Each year, my office handles approximately 35,000 felony cases alone. Those are just the felonies, 35,000 and above. In addition to all of our other statutory responsibilities, those are just the felony cases. We cannot take just the easy cases or the ones that make the evening news. We handle each and every case that comes through the door, and the individual caseloads of my assistant state's attorneys are among the highest in the nation. Every time you see a headline about a shooting, it ends up on my desk. And so far, just this year, more than 400 shootings have occurred in Cook County. The issue of police-involved shootings has obviously commanded great attention, and I want to address the issue with all of you here today. I think it's important to start with a discussion about my decision to charge an on-duty Chicago police officer for first-degree murder in the on-duty shooting incident for the first time in the history of Cook County. Much has been said already about the murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald and the joint investigation conducted by my office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the FBI following his death. Because the federal investigation still continues today, there are details that I cannot comment on or elaborate about, but there are very important reasons why I enlisted the FBI to conduct a thorough and meticulous investigation on this case. I have personally prosecuted police cases, and I understand what it takes to build a case that will result in a conviction. This is particularly important in a system where obtaining a conviction against a police officer can be exceedingly difficult because under Illinois law, a defendant has the right to choose a bench trial over a jury trial in this state. Call it what you want, but the plain fact is we have much more difficulty in obtaining guilty verdicts in a bench trial versus a jury trial, particularly in cases involving police officer defendants. In 2015 story in the Washington Post examined more than 5,000 police shootings over the last 10 years and identified only 54 cases in which a police officer has been charged with the shooting. Of those 54 cases, only 11 convictions have been obtained against those charged police officers across the entire country. And some of those cases had full acquittals, included clear video evidence. So I know the challenges faced by prosecutors in trying to hold an officer accountable for abusing their authority. And I know we can't afford to proceed with anything but the strongest possible case. The video footage from the night of the killing of Laquan McDonald is chilling, absolutely chilling. Without question, it is a critical piece of evidence in the case against Jason Van Dyke. And I understand why a layperson might say it is the only piece of evidence a prosecutor should need. But we must build a solid and thorough investigation that includes all possible evidence available in order to develop the strongest possible case to secure a conviction. An experienced prosecutor, I understand that relying on one piece of evidence can be dangerous, particularly when the stakes are so high in a murder trial of an on-duty police officer. We seek any and all available evidence to build the strongest possible case. Justice does not come simply by arresting a person and bringing charges. That's not justice. Justice is served when we go to trial with the best possible evidence and we secure a conviction. I have never been afraid to charge any police officer. In fact, under my leadership, the state's attorney's office has charged nearly 100 law enforcement officers with crimes, including cases of excessive force. I have personally tried corrupt police officers myself and obtained convictions on those cases. But what I have never done and will never do is put a criminal case in jeopardy to score political points. I won't do it. We have seen in Baltimore what can happen when a prosecutor rushes to charge amid political and public outcry without conducting a thorough investigation to build the best possible case. Charging without a full investigation limits both the evidence collected and the legal tools available to the prosecutors. Going forward, I believe we need to do a better job of educating and communicating with the public when police shootings do occur. And I am committed to doing more to ensure the public is aware of pending or ongoing investigations into these types of cases. My office is now taking steps to post information on our website about the status of pending police shootings and the legal standards that we use in our analysis of these cases. I may not like it, but I know that political opponents and their supporters will try to score whatever points they can from a shocking case like this one, including running a television ad that claims I did nothing about the case and shows the video of the murder of Laquan McDonald. A video that Laquan's own mother said she hoped would never be released to the public. In her latest television ad, my opponent, Kim Fox, is willing to use this horrific video as a tool to score political advantage. And once again, she lies about the facts. Ms. Fox claims that I did nothing in this case for 400 days, That is simply not the truth. It's a bold-faced lie. I did the opposite of nothing. I did everything that I was expected to do as a prosecutor and I should do as a prosecutor. I enlisted the resources of the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office to develop the best possible case against Officer Van Dyke. Unfortunately, Kim Fox does not just exaggerate or stretch the truth like many politicians are known to do. She just tells bold-faced lies. She has lied about her legal experience as a prosecutor and about her unethical campaign contributions. She was found to have violated campaign finance laws and refused to accept responsibility for that, which is a basic thing that we ask all of our offenders, accept responsibility. Last week, right here at the City Club, she stood in front of an audience and told lies about the way the Cook County State's Attorney's Office charges and adjudicates cases involving juveniles. Voters can't decide if it is appropriate to use a video of a teenager getting shot to death in a campaign ad. But as a mother of four kids and a lifelong advocate for victims, I think it demonstrates a lack of taste and a lack of decency. As for me, I have spent my entire legal career in public service in the state's attorney's office because I believe that every victim deserves to have a voice, and that the citizens deserve a strong law enforcement advocate who will always make public service and public safety her number one priority. I've personally prosecuted every type of case imaginable, from gang-related homicides to domestic violence cases, cases involving sexual assault and public corruption. I've personally convicted child sexual predators and defendants who had murdered Chicago police officers. Over the course of my career, I've personally tried more than 60 felony jury trials, 10 misdemeanor jury trials, and I can honestly say I have tried hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bench trials. And no one's ever questioning that because we know what my record is. I have the numbers and I have the cases to back that up. In 2008, I ran for state's attorney because I saw the opportunity to run as an independent career prosecutor. And I think we all know what happened in 2008. I was counted out almost immediately. People would say, oh, she's a nice lady, but who's going to vote for her, you know? Who's going to vote for an Alvarez for Cook County state's attorney? That's what we were up against in 2008. And it was always refreshing to look back and say, well, you know, we had over 1 million people vote for an Alvarez for Cook County state's attorney. And clearly I was the most qualified. But in 2008, I'd never run for public office before. I was not the slated candidate, and I didn't have, and I had very, very few endorsements. But I knew then, as I know now, standing before you here today, that Cook County needs an independent prosecutor in the state's attorney's office, someone who will not be beholden to politics or politicians or influenced by special interests. Because we have to make the tough calls. We have to be able to make those calls. And with the help of a dedicated team, I'm extremely proud of the work that we have accomplished in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Unlike when I came on nearly 30 years ago, our office now reflects the diversity of the citizens that we serve. When I was hired back in 1986, yeah, so do the math, you know how old I am, I got a call from Gus Munoz, who was a first chair in the Felony Trial Division. And he said, I saw your name on the list as a new hire. I want to welcome you to the office because I think you're number five now. We have five Hispanics in the office. So you could count on one hand how many Hispanics were in the office back in 1986. So we have come a long way. And I'm very proud of our numbers, our diversity numbers, particularly when it comes to hiring of attorneys. And since 2008 to now, we have hired over 150 minority attorneys, 70 African-American, another 46 Hispanic, and the rest Asian. And so I'm very proud of those numbers because, you know, gone are the days when you could count on one hand the number of minority attorneys in the office. And I think it's important that we have that diversity. I fought for new laws to target gun crimes, including measures that target the organized structure of street gangs and crack down on gang members who commit illegal gun charges. Under my watch, I have worked with legislators to strengthen laws that give the state's attorney's office the tools to more effectively target violent crime. And we've prosecuted more gun and gang activity than ever before. But we have also made incredible progress in reforming our criminal justice system to be smarter on dealing with nonviolent and low-level crime. Because I will always continue to be tough on crime, but I keep saying we have to be smart on crime. We no longer treat low-level drug possession as a criminal act, but rather as a public health issue. We have made sweeping changes in the way that we prosecute low-level marijuana cases with dramatic results. My new drug-deferred prosecution program targets repeat offenders with addiction issues who are charged with drug offenses. These individuals are essentially removed from the criminal justice system at the bond court stage. This allows us to send even more drug offenders to treatment instead of sending them to jail. We have already seen improved outcomes as a result of these measures, with close to a 75% reduction in the number of misdemeanor drug cases being prosecuted by my office. These reforms are not just limited to drug cases. I have tripled the number of alternative sentencing and deferred prosecution programs that give low-level offenders a second chance. This is ensuring that thousands of individuals every year are avoiding incarceration and receiving the social services that they need. These programs work to ensure that individuals who make a mistake are getting a head start on rebuilding their lives rather than languishing in jail or receiving a conviction. By expanding these programs and by working with partners like Sheriff Dart and Chief Judge Tim Evans to usher in major reforms to our system, we have helped to achieve significant reductions in the population of the Cook County Jail that has made the system more efficient and saved millions for the taxpayers of Cook County. Just last year, we had over 5,400 people in some type of alternative program. And when I took over in 2008, there were only 8 different programs, alternative sentencing or prosecution programs available. We now have 32. I've been recognized by the Center for Court Innovation from New York as being one of the most progressive and innovative county prosecutor's offices in the nation, and I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that I created the first ever conviction integrity unit here in Cook County. It is my position that the subject of wrongful convictions must be dealt with in an open and a proactive manner. My job is not about racking up convictions. It's always about seeking justice, even if that measure of justice means that we must acknowledge mistakes of the past. I have vacated the convictions of 14 individuals as a result of investigations by the Conviction Integrity Unit. I have also worked closely with incarcerated individuals, defense attorneys, and organizations like the Center for Wrongful Convictions to identify convictions that merit a new investigation. But we still have so much more work to do. We still don't have the tough gun laws in place that we need to keep illegal guns off of our streets and to target those repeat felony gun offenders who are shooting up our streets and stealing innocent lives each and every day. Local and national data shows that over 60% of illegal gun offenders commit another crime within a year of them getting out of jail for that original illegal gun. And these offenders are 4 times more likely to commit a homicide. And we've been looking at those cases, and they keep coming back into the system, and not necessarily just for a gun possession, but for attempt murder, for armed robbery, for violent offenses. But current sentencing guidelines allow those charged with illegal weapon violations to serve sentences of just a few months. I have fought for years to change the laws to get tougher on illegal guns. I want to thank Representative Salusi here because he's been a champion for us down in Springfield to sponsor our bills. We haven't quite got there, Mike, but we're going to keep trying. So I have fought for years to change the laws, a change I believe will have a meaningful impact on violent crime in our city. In some quarters, I face stiff political opposition and criticism for that position. But I will not let up, and we will be continuing our efforts in Springfield this session to try to toughen penalties for felons and gang members who illegally possess firearms. In addition, I am introducing a new measure this session that would create the Class 1 felony of firearms trafficking in cases where an offender without a valid firearm FOID, firearm owner's identification card, transports a firearm or ammunition across state lines into Illinois with intent to deliver it to another person. We want to get at those straw buyers who are buying those guns and bringing them back into Illinois. We know that many of the legal guns on the street that are used in crimes are purchased outside of Illinois and sold on our streets. This measure would specifically target the straw buyers attempting to avoid Illinois FOID requirements and background checks who purchase their firearms in other states with more lenient gun regulations. And in keeping with my ongoing efforts to reform our criminal justice system, I am also proposing legislation that will revisit and revise several archaic drug-related laws. These laws have been shown to be ineffective and in many cases destructive to our own communities. There is a broad political support for criminal justice reform, and we must take advantage of this momentum to undo some of the misguided laws. Those laws emerged from the failed war on drugs. My proposals include a comprehensive realignment of sentencing categories for narcotics offenses that are currently overly punitive or unnecessary. I am proposing that we eliminate factors that trigger sentencing enhancements for certain narcotics offenses and make more nonviolent offenses eligible for alternative sentencing and probation. My legislative team has already been in Springfield laying the groundwork for these important measures, and I am optimistic that we can find common ground. It is clear to me that our legislature must find the will and the courage to do more when it comes to gun penalties. Collectively, my policy agenda aims to shift our prosecutorial and corrections resources from nonviolent drug and property offenders towards illegal gun offenders and gang members who pose a greater risk of violence to our communities. I believe that these legislative proposals are very well balanced in recognizing that we have an overburdened prison system using stretched taxpayer dollars, but at the same time maintaining the paramount interest of public safety and my mission to advocate on behalf of the victims of crime. I could go on and on about the work of my office, but I know that part of the program will be questions, and we'll get to that, so I'll start wrapping it up. But I want to close by telling you one last running story. Last week when I was out for my run, I was stopped by a woman in Oak Park. She told me that a close family member had been the victim of a violent crime, and the state's attorney's office had helped to convict this defendant who committed the crime. This woman touched my hand, and she had tears in her eyes when she told me how grateful she was that the justice she had received. Then she told me to keep running, to keep fighting, and to continue to do the right thing. And that's exactly what I intend to do. I joined this office back in 1986 because I have a passion to help victims of crime, and I've been doing it all these years. Lord knows I could have left years ago and made lots of money in the private sector, but I haven't done it. I haven't done it because this is my passion, and this has always been my passion, and this is my job. And, you know, being the Cook County State's Attorney, I always say, you know, no matter what decision you make, someone's unhappy. That's just the way it is. But you can't run away from the tough decisions. You can't run away from the tough cases. You gotta tackle them head on. And that's what I'm doing. And it's what I'm going to continue to do. I am a fighter. I am someone who ran those streets in Pilsen. And Lord knows the Sisters of St. Casimir from Maria High School have trained me well. And my Loyola, I got to give a shout out to my undergraduate Loyola. I am a Rambler. LaRue, I'm a Rambler. And the wonderful education I got there, but it taught me many things. To be tough, to be passionate, is service. The Jesuits are all about service. And serving the people of Cook County and the city of Chicago, Chicago I grew up in, that I love. And this is my job, and I intend to keep it, and I will continue to fight. I will continue to run each and every day. So I want to thank you for listening to me this morning.
The moderator never likes to jump in but to confirm something, but I can confirm. If you graduate from Maria High School, you're tough. I got 46 years of that, so no one has to... Right, Stella? Absolutely. All right. We'll ask the McDonald question, but since everyone else is asking about it, all right, here we go. No high school connection here, but Graham Grady, where are you?
Over here.
Go Panthers. All right. Today's Sun-Times endorsement of Kim Fox suggests the African-American community may have lost confidence in what message you have for black voters.
Well, the endorsement is from the paper, from the Sun-Times, not from the community. And I think that the message to all communities that I serve, and particularly the African-American community, is, again, I do my job each and every day. And unfortunately, what I have seen in all these years is that the African-American community, the Latino community, minority communities are disproportionately victimized by the crime that is widespread throughout this county. So each and every day, I'm putting my name on the record on behalf of a victim, a minority victim, who has been victimized, and particularly in of violent crime. So my message to all communities is that this is my passion, and every time we pick up a case and every time we go to court and try a case, it's to get justice for the victims of crime. You know, the endorsements endorsements don't mean a great deal to me, because I think what we've seen over the years in all of these races is that, you know, it's the people who vote. It's the voices of the citizens who vote each and every election, and not necessarily a newspaper.
Shar Rivette from the Chicago Children's Advocacy Center. Where are you? Right? Well, right. Thank you for your partnership in seeking justice for child sexual abuse victims. What are your plans to increase the number of child sexual... Just comment on that. It got a little redundant there. It's not easy reading these questions.
Well, first of all, Shar, I want to say we have a great working relationship, and obviously if you don't know what the Children's Advocacy Center does, some great, tremendous work, and it's a wonderful place for the victims of child victims of sexual abuse. We will continue to staff our ASAs at that location. I'd love to have more resources and to give you more. As I indicated earlier, my budget has continuously been cut, and we always have to kind of rearrange to make sure we have people in the courtroom and keep them up and running. But I know that we've got some new initiatives that we're looking at, I know with human trafficking victims, and potentially doing some interviews there at the CAC. So there are things that we're going to continue to do. I'd like to put more people there. I'm not sure I'll be able to achieve that, but you got my word that we love the work that you do, but the entire staff does. And if you've never been there, I would say you should contact Shar and try to get a tour, because it really is amazing, all the work that's done at the Advocacy Center.
A couple more. Susan Brown. Where are you, Susan? Cowards die many times before they're dead, Susan. You could raise your hand. All right. Well, she's not a City Club member, probably. She's embarrassed. All right. As a prosecutor, you cannot impact violent crime by yourself. What do you need from other leaders in the community, members, etc.?
Well, I touched on it with the laws. You know, I think I need help in Springfield to make sure that the legislature wakes up and sees the need for making our laws stronger in order to combat these crimes. And through community, you know, one of the things that we found so effective, I opened up 4 community justice centers. I'd like to open more. In fact, that was part of my budget proposal this year, which, of course, was denied, because those community offices are great. And there's one up north, one south, one centrally located by UIC, and one out in Oak Park. And the good thing about those community offices is that they're right there in the community. People can walk in, ask a question. Sometimes we develop cases through issues that come brought to our attention there. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's just simply helping the person to get on, you know, get the right answer, or sending them to their, you know, the appropriate city, you know, department to get answers. And it's great to have them in the community. Because why? Because they work with the community organizations. They work with the police department. They do seminars. They do training. They do, you know, highlight maybe training for seniors so they won't be victims of fraud. We do a lot of gang stuff, gang awareness, lectures and that sort of thing. So it's to be active in the community. And when we have that community involvement, I think you see a difference. Because if the community is engaged and knows that we are engaged and that we want to help clean up this street or clean, we had some great success up in the uptown neighborhood, Alderman Kappelman's area, great success. And why? Because the community was all involved. We cleaned up really a strip mall, and the police calls from that particular area went from being 80% of their calls were to that strip mall down to like 12% because of the work that we did to get everybody involved. So it's important for the community to be engaged, because we listen to you and we need you to come and tell us what the issues are. And so our community justice centers are tremendous. I'd like to open more, and we're going to keep trying. I know the door keeps getting closed on me, but I'm going to keep trying. But it's so important to have that connection to the community so that we know what the issues are.
We have three more questions, many of them combined. Susan Simonson. Susan, where are you? City club members always raise their hand, right? Be proud. What is your position on the mentally ill in the criminal justice system?
You know, I've heard Tom Dart several times say that, you know, he feels like he has the biggest mental health institution as opposed to the jail, and he has a point, a very good point. We have now created the mental health courts that didn't exist before, and that's tremendous. But I do think there is a lot more work that needs to be done, and I've been looking at what they're starting to do in New York, and that is, number one, I think we've got to have the specialized training, Chief McCarthy back there, it's specialized training for police officers on how to handle the situation where the offender is mentally ill. Is it appropriate to arrest him and take him and to get him in the system? Or maybe what we should be doing is what they're doing in New York, is taking them straight to a facility. So they're not bringing them to the jail. They're not bringing them to the station. And they're taking them to a facility. We don't have that here. And I don't see the county or the city creating those mental health facilities. I think that's necessary. And I think the training of the officers, so the officers know what to do with this particular individual and what's the best way to treat them. I am happy that we now have seven mental health courts throughout Cook County that didn't exist before. And we're seeing, some success with treating these people. But there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And I would like to be able to see officers having that ability and that opportunity to bypass the criminal justice system and be able to get these people into treatment.
Okay. Now, we have a couple of questions. We seldom have one name, sort of like the Brazilian soccer team. Xavier, where are you? All right. There you go, Xavier. Nice long question. Thanks. Your office has it's on the Dante Severn case.
Servant.
Who serves on – you filed a manslaughter charge. The judge – said it was the wrong, incorrect charge. What is your response?
On the Dante Servin case, which was the off-duty shooting that took the life of Rekia Boyd, I charged the manslaughter case because I charged what I felt that we could prove. This case was investigated. This case, my top team of prosecutors who handle these types of cases went through it with a fine-tooth comb. It's unethical for me to bring charges that I can't prove. And I did not believe that we could sustain the proof for first-degree murder charge. I wholeheartedly disagree with Judge Porter's ruling, absolutely disagree with Judge Porter's ruling. And I think if you read his ruling, it's legal gymnastics is the best how I could describe it, how he got to that ruling, which implied that he would have found him guilty. Well, he didn't say that, but implied that the appropriate charge was first-degree murder. I would not have been able to sustain my burden on first-degree murder. I brought the charges that I felt I could prove. And we were shocked at his ruling. We were shocked at his opinion. And, when we looked at that case, again, whenever we look at these cases, it's the victim that you're thinking of. And what bothered me the absolute most about that case, because there were all kinds of tentacles on that case, was the fact that Ms. Boyd lost her life. She was walking down the alley. She was not in any kind of confrontation with that officer. And you know, for her to lose her life for absolutely nothing, that's why we kept coming back to charge. There were people advising me not to charge anything. And I felt very strongly that that was not the right decision, that this officer, you know, on off duty needed to be charged. And unfortunately, we have to live with that ruling. I disagree with that ruling. I think the judge is wrong with that ruling. The case law supports me. And so it's a very disappointing ruling that unfortunately, you know, we have to live with.
Okay. Moderator has to jump in. Okay. If that had been a jury trial, would it have been a different verdict?
It could have been. It could have been. I mean, you know, you can only speculate. You know, I mentioned earlier, and I'm not being, you know, dishonest about that. We seem to have a better record when we take these cases to a jury.
Okay. Last question. Led by Charlie Gardner and some other people. What a surprise. The McDonald case. It's about the video. The question is, well, it's a two question. Why was the video not released sooner? I think you answered that in your speech. The other part is the U.S. I'm trying to paraphrase. You have suggested that your prosecution in the McDonald case was delayed by the feds. Did the U.S. Attorney's Office ever specifically ask you to delay or hold off on returning the indictment?
Well, no, the U.S. Attorney's Office never asked me that, but we started this investigation as a joint investigation with the FBI being our investigative agency, the U.S. Attorney's Office being my partner on this case. We do many joint investigations, and normally when we do a joint investigation, we conclude it together. And, you know, some cases are taken federally, some charges go state. So in this particular case, no one ever told me to hold off or to delay. As we stand here today, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office still has not finished his investigation. The FBI was a tremendous partner, and I stand firm in my decision to involve the FBI because they brought to the table so many resources that I wouldn't have had through IPRA and locally. And but when you do work, the downside when you do joint investigations is that the time frame and then the pace on the federal side is not the same as ours. It just isn't. But with that being said, I would make the same decision again because we were able to develop evidence, and I can't go into specifics, unfortunately, because the investigation still continues and there's a decorum order by Judge Gahan right now because the case is pending. So I can't go into specifics, but to say that, you know, as I said earlier, you know, making an arrest and charging someone is not justice. Our goal is at the conclusion of that trial, that he's going to be held accountable for what he did. That's our goal. And so in order to get there, you want to build the strongest case possible. And you want, you know, one piece of evidence. I've lost cases where I had five eyewitnesses and it was a not guilty. So you want to make sure that you have all the corroborating evidence and strongest evidence possible.
How about a round of applause?